thing. She's gone on to do some really terrific work with Family Connections, which Perry will not tell us about because she can't speak, but we'll fill in a little bit later. I also think that Marie Paul is an example of dialectic. You know, sometimes it's said, I think rather flatteringly, that, you know, good therapists make good parents. And by the way, there's no evidence for that at all. But it's not a bad idea for those of us who are therapists to entertain that possibility. But Marie Paul's recently gone back to school to become a therapist, and she's definitely good evidence that good parents can become good therapists. So Marie Paul.
Hi, everyone. After this wonderful presentation, I don't think anything I will say will come as a surprise to you. And it will show you what it looks like from the other side, the family side. But before I do that, there are several people here today that I am so happy to have a chance to thank in person because you have had such a profound impact on my and my family's life. Dr. Linehan, what can I say? There is not a shred of doubt in my mind that my child owes the life that she has today, thanks to your vision decades ago in tackling these desperate patients and developing DBT. And it's my honor to be here and to thank you. Thank you. Dr. Hoffman and Dr. Frizzetti, you have created an organization and a family education program for parents that is simply extraordinary. Those of us lucky enough to facilitate those classes to other family members, as I have for 4 years now, are privileged to see lives changed every day by them, just as ours has been. Thank you. Thank you. I am a mom to a son and to a wonderful daughter who 4 years ago presented with 8 of the 9 criteria for BPD. I am sharing this story with you today with my daughter's support in the hope to encourage others to be open about it too. There is such stigma about the disorder, and the silence only serves to perpetuate this stigma. So I'm hoping that people will be a little more open about this. There are 3 overarching themes that are relevant to families that I'd like to share with you. You have heard how BPD is so prevalent and how it is so devastating to patients. It tears families apart. It really does. The second theme that I can tell you about is that good parenting skills and a lot of love will not make much of a difference, but DBT skills will. And thirdly, and I also have seen that firsthand, family support is absolutely imperative for patients and for their families. Doesn't work without it. So I'll tell you a little bit about our journey. We adopted our daughter. She was 2.5. She was a hurt child. And she was very difficult to raise. At age 7, she informed us that she was an oppositor. What that meant was, I choose to oppose everything that you say to me. But, you know, she made progress every year, and we delighted in the progress. And she grew into perhaps the most generous person that I know, really. By high school, she was able to independently raise thousands of dollars for various charities, go on relief mission trips, teach religious education. I didn't make her do any of this stuff. She was, you know, doing it on her own. By her senior year, she had been accepted to 7 of the 8 colleges that she had applied to. It turns out that is also the year that she had started abusing drugs heavily. She had been cutting for 3 years. She had been in therapy that entire time. So now 4 years ago, I had never heard the words borderline personality disorder, didn't know what that was, and our family entered a world of total family chaos, devastation, that included drugs, alcohol, completely unpredictable, dangerous, self-destructive behaviors that made no sense to us at all. We just didn't get it. She threatened to jump out of a car that she was in with friends on the highway one time. She was burning herself, even after she had been treated by several therapists and even gone to a pretty well-known rehab clinic. She remained undiagnosed, or rather misdiagnosed, and her illness had escalated to the point that, for example, one night she was in my car and she fled out of the car in nothing much more than a t-shirt and a pair of jeans, and it was sub-freezing temperatures, and it was a pretty bad neighborhood, and we didn't find her until the next day. And it's amazing that she was okay. Just miraculous. It was a year into this nightmare that I finally understood her condition. Her therapist and her treatment team were really pushing us hard to send her yet to another rehab. I had started getting the inkling that maybe she was medicating something. It wasn't quite clear to me, but I was doing sort of that travel alone because, of course, her therapists weren't helping me along that way. So I was desperately searching for answer, and I came across the McLean Hospital website, and there I saw John Gunderson's booklet on borderline personality disorder, saw the symptoms, and, you know, it just clicked. It was pretty evident. It is when we discovered that BPD existed that things took a turn to the better for us in our family. So I dragged her there. She didn't want to go much, but I dragged her there. I don't think I had heard her voice be anything other than angry for a year. And then she met the treatment team there. With surgical precision, they validated her, and in about 20 minutes, they established her rapport. And when she walked out of that meeting, it was the first, as I said, the first time that I heard a different voice, and it was sort of a 5-year-old, scared little voice that said, "Can I please stay here? I think I can get better." So, of course, she stayed. She stayed there for 4 weeks. She learned the skills of DBT continually, and it was residential treatment, and it was every moment. They called her a star student. She would wake up in the middle of the night to talk to some therapist. She just wanted to get better. It was so important to her. And then she came home, and it wasn't easy when she came home. It wasn't 4 weeks magic. It was still hard. But my husband and I, in the meantime, had discovered this wonderful organization, NEA BPD, and we joined a family connections class. Actually, it was a teleconnections class, because I did not want to take the class without my husband. What we had determined was the importance of all of us getting a common vocabulary, understanding what she was going through altogether. What it did, more than a common vocabulary, which was really important, was it allowed us to understand the work that our daughter was doing. And yes, she was doing it, but we could see what she was doing in the moment that she was doing it. And at least at first, because validation was so hard for me particularly at first, it allowed me to avoid invalidation when she was working hard at her skills. So that was wonderful. So my second point, that a lot of love and typically good parenting skills alone don't help much. Our son is 20, so I'm not sure he's ready quite yet to vouch for the fact that we've been good parents, supportive, loving, patient. But you know we have. We really have. And through this awful time of chaos, when we knew nothing, we still kept trying, and we were there. And everything we did back then appeared useless, even though we were trying. In fact, it didn't appear useless. I think everything we did made things worse. And there's nothing worse for a parent than to really try and see things just escalate down like that. What the Family Connections class did for us is it gave us support. It gave us an understanding of the illness and of our daughter's behaviors, and it taught us skills. So we learned about the practice of relationship mindfulness, and we called it mindfulness, and about our rights as relatives. It taught us that we have rights as relatives. We learned that it was okay to observe limits, and we also learned how to brace ourselves for the consequences of the limits we were setting, and those consequences weren't always pretty. We practiced reframing what we thought of as manipulation. And we learned to see that at any moment, our child was indeed doing the best that she could. And that we too were doing the best that we could. And that the outcome of her doing the best that she could and us doing the best that she could might still not work out very well in that moment. But that it was important to keep trying. to not take that as failure, to just take that as the next step. We learned the ultimate dialectic, that as parents, we could be right, we often were right, and that our child could be right also, even though in appearance, everything was contradictory. It was hard. It was really hard work. And at first, it really was not intuitive. It became so after a while, but at first it wasn't. The payback, though, for us was truly, practically instantaneous. And over the past 3 years, it has kept growing amazingly. And I will give you examples of that. But way at the beginning of us parents practicing DBT skills, we started to remember that we were good parents, that we were trying hard, and to accept the moment. And we started to learn that it was important to just keep trying more than having success each time. For all the work that we've done, I promise you, our daughter has worked 3 times as hard. She has come so far, and I'll give you an example just from this last week, and she functions really well. She had to have wisdom teeth extracted, and for a couple of weeks, she'd been quite fearful of that. She was afraid of the pain. She was afraid of the sounds. She just, you know. She was in the middle of it, and the sound got to her, and she thought she could feel pain. And so fear just got a hold of her. And she explained to me that she saw the moment she was just going to get up in the middle of the surgery and just leave. She couldn't take it anymore. So she remembered her skills, and she brought all her focus to the hand of the assistant who was holding her chin. And she was able to really completely focus on that so that the fear died down a little. But that's not enough, right? What she really had to do was face the fear. And she remembered that. So once she was able to calm herself down, then she faced the fear. And she allowed herself to hear the sounds and to realize that there was no pain. That's the kind of hard work I'm talking about. I'm not sure I could do it, but you know, that's what she practices. So this is the outcome of DBT skills for her 3 years later. She has a full-time job. She's nannying for 5 children. That family that she nannies for loves her dearly, pays her well. She just bought herself a new used car. She attends university full-time. She's probably going to go into social work. She has tried to live independently. It didn't work out. It was pretty disastrous. But the skills that she is missing for that, well, you know, she's learning them right now. And she really wants to be independent. So she'll try again. And my guess is next time it'll work out. We'll see. But, you know, not attached to the outcome here. There are some difficult moments. There are some borderline days still. Of course there are. But her life is beyond what we ever thought it could be just a few years ago. And the most important thing of all is, of course, we have hope, but she has hope for her life. And that's what is really, truly key. So I can say to you with absolute certainty that we wouldn't be here today without DBT as a family. She wouldn't, and we wouldn't. I can also say with similar certainty that most of the parents I have met through the classes that I have facilitated in the past few years would say the same. And this is my third point, that family support is absolutely imperative for relatives and for patients. In your handbook, you will see quite a few notes of thanks from parents who have taken the classes. And we could fill volumes with their words. But I will tell you a few right now. The change that I see between the start of the classes, the family support classes, and the end is absolutely extraordinary. So a mom from New York said to me, "We are forever indebted to you for pulling us back from the brink." A dad from Utah, who now teaches his own classes, and I think he's here today, told me that one of his participants said, "This class has become an absolute lifesaver for my sanity. I have been gaining so much knowledge, and I'm beginning to see through the eyes of a person with BPD. It is easy to keep on loving someone with BPD when you try to understand the way they are feeling." And he's so right. A couple from Maine said to me, "You may recall that our daughter, a recent law school graduate, was in rehab and expecting a child. She and our grandson, who is a great source of delight for us, are now living with us. This never would have been possible without the skills and understanding that we acquired in the class. And finally, a very recent graduate from a class we just finished 3 weeks ago in Connecticut said to me, "The program for me was life-changing. I have been struggling with my daughter and our relationship for years. I have seen professionals that were helpful, but nothing came close to this program. Recently, my daughter became very upset, and I was, of course, the target. I managed to stay calm, listen to her, and validate the emotion I thought she was feeling. It worked, all capitals. We have a long way to go, but this was huge." So now they too have hope, and they're engaged in the work. A wonderful participant from the class in Connecticut that we just finished pointed out to me one day that DBT skills have helped her tremendously with her child, but that they really came in handy when she met with the principal of her child's school. DBT is a way of life. You know, once you start with DBT skills, you use them everywhere. Today, we have over 500 families who are signed up on our NEA BPD waiting list, and anywhere from 3 to 6 more sign up every day. And every single one of their stories is absolutely heartbreaking. It is our next challenge to help them all. I hope my story and some of the thoughts from others that I've shared with you have shown you how DBT has impacted so many of us. The adaptation and dissemination of DBT to families is absolutely, absolutely invaluable. And we hope you will help us do that. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marie-Paul. I want to mention that part of the reason that we're dovetailing Marcia's presentation this morning about the state of DBT with a little bit about families right now is because, in fact, some of the first breakouts, some of the first adaptations of DBT really were with family members. Actually, Perry Hoffman, that I'm about to introduce, I think started some of those applications very early on, even while the first DBT outcome studies were being conducted. And others of us have worked on that since. So I now want to introduce Perry. I don't know if she's going to say anything, but I want to introduce her anyway. And why do I want to do that if she's lost her voice? Okay. But Perry, you know, is the president of the National Education Alliance for BPD and has been involved in the creation of a number of DBT programs in the New York area. But actually, the best word to describe Perry is to describe her as a magician. Not the kind that you might see in Las Vegas, but a real magician. She created NEA BPD out of thin air, just like that. And from there, managed to get so many key people in the area of borderline personality disorder involved and organized and on a mission that it's actually hard to imagine. She also, as a magician, she actually bends time, because I find that when I go to bed and everyone else in the world is sleeping, between the hours of 3 and 5 a.m., Perry has a full day's work accomplished, and work for the rest of us to do is in our inbox when we wake up. So Perry's terrific in that respect. I don't know how to convey the amount of energy that she has and compassion that she has for working with patients, but also with family members. She and I worked on the phone every week for I don't know how long to create Family Connections program. But anyway, I do want to introduce Dr. Perry Hoffman. Perry, come up and at least let us see who you are.
Thanks very much. This is 3 hours later, and I haven't really talked, so I don't know why it's gone. But I do want to say that Alan and I were both doing independent work, and Marcia said to us that you both have to meet. And so she introduced us. And it's a different kind of marriage, but it's a marriage that's really worked. Because we've supported each other, we've done a lot of good things together, and It's been a wonderful opportunity. I also want to say that this organization is not just me. I get to be the face on it most often, but there are family members who are driving all of this. Some of them are here. Some of them who are founding members who come to the conference today. This is an organization that's all volunteer-driven. No one has ever gotten paid for any of their time, and it's all done with a passion to help families. And as I said before, the halls, and we have a family in Los Angeles that's amazing. Marie Paul, I could just go down the list of all of our family connections that are online now, sending me emails. This is amazing. We're sitting here with our group. We're sitting here with our daughters, just watching this conference this morning. But this is a family-driven organization, and I just get to sort of be a face on it sometimes. So I thank you. Alan's now going to present the data on family connections, and then I hope that we have a few minutes to answer some questions with Marcia and Marie Paul together. Thank you.
Thanks, Perry. There aren't too many people I could do this with, but they're Perry's slides, but I'm going to present them since she can't speak so well. But I'm actually not going to present them all. But I wanted to start just with a little context. So I want to give you an example, because I think that the role of families in the development, maintenance, treatment and relapse prevention of borderline personality disorder is a complicated one and one that's often misunderstood. Marcia talked about transactions, and transactions, I think, are very intuitively complicated. So I want to give you an example. So as everybody I hope is familiar with the story of Bambi. That's Bambi the deer, okay? Just want to be clear. Now, I got to tell you, if you haven't seen Bambi, I'm going to give you a spoiler alert. You may not listen to the story. I'm going to give away some key details of the film, okay? Now, Bambi was the little deer raised by a single mother and an abandoned father, a father who abandoned him. And, of course, what happens to Bambi, the pivotal point, the scary point in the story is what? Bambi's mother is shot. Right. Now, this is 1939, right? So it's tasteful. You don't see the bullet going in slow motion. The head's not exploding. Bambi's mother's shot off screen without any blood, okay? But everybody knows. Okay, so that's the key thing. And you need to know that the dad's been gone for a while. So it's not clear. Is Bambi going to be alone? Is Bambi, you know, okay. So here's the situation. So imagine you've got a couple of children who've never seen Bambi. And just to make the story kind of simple, imagine you've got one parent, okay? Imagine one of those children is emotionally just kind of sensitive, maybe very sensitive, more reactive, takes a little longer to soothe, longer to bring back down to emotional baseline. And let's imagine the other child is normative on those things. Okay, these are not good things or bad things. They're just normative, meaning kind of like average, and like most things, they're distributed. So some people are more extreme. So Bambi gets shot. Boom, so they're watching Bambi they've rented Bambi at the store. Okay, so, Bambi doesn't get shot, sorry. Bambi's mother gets shot. That's the whole fear, right? Oh, no! Okay, so Bambi's mother gets shot. Thank you for that correction. It's my fantasy, sorry. Okay, I've told this story too many times. So, Bambi's mother gets shot, and the two children do what children do. When they see this on the movie, they get kind of the lip, I can't kind of do this on cue, but their lower lip starts to quiver and their eyes well up with tears. And they turn around and they look at the parent. Pretty ordinary thing. And so, okay, here's the test. So parents and people who might be parents or could be parents or who've had parents, what do you do? You've heard Marcia, you know the answer to this is you validate, right? And you validate and you say things like, of course that's scary. You know, poor Bambi, right? You validate the emotional experience. It's hard to watch this. And you maybe provide some soothing. You know, sit up on my lap, and I'll give you a little cuddling. You know, so you do things to actually help the child re-regulate his or her emotion. Okay? Now, the thing is that with a normatively, you know, sensitive, reactive child, they're going to return back to baseline. That soothing and that validation is going to help, and their arousal is going to come back down. For the child who's a little bit more sensitive, a little bit more reactive, and has a harder time calming down, that child, after a couple of minutes of soothing and validation, is still kind of upset. Okay? And then, of course, now ordinary parents that we are, what do we do next? Yeah, maybe a little bit less patience. We say, okay, maybe we'll just take a little break. Okay, that's not bad. Give you a little more time to re-regulate. Okay, you know, so we'll take a little break, hit the pause button. We'll keep the pause button on, and, you know, maybe we'll go get a little snack or a glass of water. We'll just take a break for a moment, and we'll come back. Okay, now, by this point, the child with the ordinary temperament, the ordinary amounts of emotion sensitivity and reactivity is back down to baseline. But the other one's not. It's still hard. That child hasn't returned to baseline. It's still upset. And when you sit back down to start watching, it re-triggers the child. And the child, oh, poor Bambi. Okay, you get the idea. So at some point, even the most loving parent, now I got to point out, now there's a whole range of parents. Okay, so far we've got a pretty good parent. Some parents with the first sight of this would actually not be so validating. Okay, so, you know, okay, if you're going to cry, we're not going to watch. Okay, kind of, right? I don't think that's actually something you call the United Nations about, right? It's just not terribly validating. And other parents could, you know, there's a lot of invalidating things parents can do too. But there's the point is there's a whole range of responses. But even a very loving, very validating parent, after 10, 15 minutes of this, and the other kid saying, come on, I want to see the rest of the movie, that ordinary parent could say something like, you need to stop. You need to stop crying. And if you can't stop crying, we're not going to watch. And I don't think that that's necessarily a harsh or terrible thing to do. In fact, for some children, that's very important. It's social information. That the world will only tolerate so much emotion before the world starts pushing back, and I'm tolerating more and helping you. Okay, so good enough. But for some kids, that 1% of kids who just can't do it, it's tough. And eventually the parent says, okay, you need to cut it out. Okay, you're ruining this for the experience for your brother or your sister or for the rest of the family. Now, that's a big stimulus, and that creates another emotion. So instead of the fear and the sadness that the child had before, now the child has some shame. Right? I'm ruining this for you. That shame has a different action or a different action urge associated with it, like to hide. So the child stops crying and turns around, stops bothering everybody else. Okay? And then the parent pats the kid on the head and says, that's right, and then starts the movie. Okay? So kind of saying shame works, okay? Now, is that invalidating? Well, it's complicated. It's invalidating of the child's sadness. It's invalidating of the child's fear. But it's also not necessarily invalidating from a social perspective of what's acceptable in the world. So in family connections, our job is to help parents along the whole continuum. Parents and partners. I'm going to leave out partners, and I don't want to infantilize adults or teenagers with BPD. It's just a story. But the idea is that there's a whole range. If we're people who get really impatient right away, we've got to learn how to have more patience and see this experience differently from the point of view of the other person. If we have got a fair amount of patience in some skill, we've got to learn how to not maybe cave in too quickly and actually hang in there. I mean, then there may be a whole other set of skills we need, which is really how to validate deeply when that's not the most obvious thing to do. So in family connections, we do this. It's not just validation, but all the things that we need to learn in order to be able to validate. We do this in actually 12 weeks with multiple family members present in a group format. It's community-based. Family connections is a grassroots program. We train people to do family connections for free, and then they offer the program for free. Family members could include parents and partners, but also adult children or even friends sometimes and siblings. We teach DBT skills and strategies straight from Marsh's manual. We also have adapted and extended those skills to family-specific situations. So mindfulness has, for example, relationship mindfulness applications. And validation is how to validate yourself while being able to validate the other person. We have a manual. It's semi-structured. We teach people how to follow it. We train them and so forth. Let's see. We really think about this as having three main components. One is a psychoeducational component, where we give people the best current information we have about borderline personality disorder, about emotion, about family functioning, about available treatments, and a variety of other things. The second component is skills, individual skills and family and relationship skills. And the third component comes out of doing the other two, which is the natural social support that comes from being in a group with other relatives. So these three parts, we're not sure that one or two of them may be more important than the others. We're not sure, but the three parts are all present. We have in the last couple of years started trying to deliver this instead of doing it in person. We also do it over the telephone in conference calls to be able to have it available to people where there isn't a physical group present. We've got two published studies that we've published, as well as a replication from abroad, demonstrating a fair amount of really effective outcomes, which I just want to summarize in 1 minute. One of the things that parents and partners describe, and this is very much what Marie-Paul was talking about and also what Marcia was talking about, is that sometimes you don't have the life you want. And when you don't have what you want, you've experienced a loss. You might have actually had it and lost it, or it was just an idea that got lost along the way. And so there's a lot of grief. And what you see here, three points in time. Before family connections is the orange, the yellow is at the end of the 12-week program, and then the green is a 6-month follow-up later without further intervention. And as you can see, these are all significant changes. These are from grief goes down precipitously from before to after and then continues going down significantly into the follow-up period. Changes in distress and depression using the BDI can actually come down precipitously and stay down during the follow-up period. And changes in the burden experienced for caregivers, for people who love somebody who's suffering, that's often experienced as a burden. A burden in a variety of ways, not necessarily instrumentally, but certainly emotionally. And burden comes down significantly from pre to post and continues into the follow-up period as well. The other side is, of course, the idea of mastery. Okay, if we're teaching skills, we want people to also be able to experience that and be able to be more skillful, to know that they're more skillful and have that affect their experience. And, in fact, mastery goes up significantly from pre to post and then continues on into the follow-up period. So we actually see quite a few outcomes. Now, these outcomes are the same essentially through all three of our published studies, pretty essentially the same. I do want to note, though, that even in at the end of the follow-up period for grief, burden, depression, and mastery, that these are not actually results that end up in the exactly around community means. There's still an effect of having a loved one who's suffering. So burden and grief and mastery are still not quite at the normal normative level, although they're much, much closer, and they're in the normal range. Teleconnections we're currently trying to evaluate. We assume that doing it on the phone has similar kinds of outcomes, but we're not sure. But that's our hope. I guess I'm going to stop here because we're almost out of time. And if you want more information about family connections, you can go to the NEA BPD website, borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. And here's Perry.
I wonder if we can take a few more questions with Marcia and Marie-Paul.
Maybe have Marcia come up and Marie-Paul, and we'll spend just a couple of more minutes with questions that people might have.
I just wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, please do.
Am I on?
You're on.
Okay. I just wanted to make a comment because all the stories that we've heard so far have actually been from parents and families. But I actually get loads of phone calls from brothers and sisters. And I really believe even in the invalidating environment that we've been talking about, it's very easy to overstress the role of parents and understress the role of siblings. And for many people in their family, especially, you know, if you have older brothers or an older sibling who you really look up to. So I'm hoping, I don't know how much you do with siblings. I get calls from siblings all the time, and I really want to encourage you all and me and my friends and family, where we do pretty much the same thing, but it's a little bit longer, to really start paying more attention to looking at a broader network of the environment, even to friends, you know.
Yeah, they're always welcome.
And to look at the data for these groups. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say as a person who talks a lot to siblings. And
thanks. No, I think that's an excellent point. And they're always welcome in family connections, siblings and friends.
And in fact, things have changed a great deal. The 4 years ago, it was really pretty much mostly parents.
Yeah.
The most recent one, I had two spouses in the group, as well as one neighbor and two sisters.
Yeah.
So I think that's great. The profile of people.
I think that's great.
It's wonderful.
I really think it's great. Yeah.